Great. Well, great to see everyone here, and welcome to those who we haven't seen in a little while, and welcome back, and welcome to those who are coming in for the first time. So hang on, I'm just gonna fix my speakers. Hold time. Can I turn my head? Yep. Good. Terrific to see you all here, and so for those who haven't met me, my name is Sam. I'm a pastor or a minister of a church, and so I help run this evening church service, and you can see there's many young people here. And my background before I started working for the church was I worked as a doctor, and I studied at the University of Tasmania in Sandy Bay as well as in Launceston, and trained to become a doctor. And I worked for a few years in Launceston, and I worked up in Sydney. And but then that was the second best job in the world for me. My favorite job, the thing that I have the most passion about, is teaching about the Bible and teaching about Jesus, because for me, that's the most important thing in the world. The most important thing in the world. And the consequences are, well, I believe, are eternal. And so it's very significant. And so I'm very keen to share, because I think it's the best news in the world, and it's for everyone. And so that's why I'm very keen to teach the Bible, but also answer the hard questions that many people have about the Bible. And we're going to be looking at three different topics. So tonight we're going to be thinking about science and all the questions that people have about science that often block them from learning more about Jesus in the Bible. Over the next couple of weeks, we'll also be looking at the trying to make sense of God as well, and think about, well, you know, we hear a lot about social justice in our culture, so you know, what does God have to say on those kinds of issues? And then the last one's also a very big topic in our culture about identity. Young people these days, they're trying to work out who I am, who they are. And so we'll also spend some time doing that. What I'm going to do is break up the talks into three parts, and so I'm going to talk it for about so three parts, and each one will be 8 minutes long, and then you'll have in between an opportunity to chat for about, I don't know, 5 odd minutes about what I've just spoken about. And so you can talk a lot, or you can talk a little, and or talk none at all, not at all. And it's up to you to how you want to think about it. Some people like, if you're like me, I'm more of a introvert, so I like to kind of internally process in my man cave, and then when I've worked out everything I want to say, then I'll come out and contribute. Other people like to go blah and just spit out lots of words and work out the answers out there and stumble across that what they think. So but we're going to start with this topic. Hasn't science disproved Christianity? Hasn't science disproved Christianity? Now, many of you will have heard of that high-profile atheist called Richard Dawkins. He's written a number of books, and he said this, he claimed this. He said, "Religion has now been completely superseded by science." Now, for those of you who perhaps your English is your second language, what he's saying is, religion, or Christianity in particular, it's been completely overtaken, overshadowed by science, the belief in science. Now, there's many other atheists. They're best-selling kind of authors, not just Richard Dawkins, but other men like Daniel Dennett, Sam Harris, and Christopher Hitchens. They too argue that science in general, and evolutionary science in particular, has made belief in God unnecessary. So we're going to think about a bit more about that tonight. And it's very common to hear this in schools and universities, that people will say that science has disproved God. And my guess is that many in our culture who have sort of perhaps persuaded by this argument also assume that religion is in decline. It's going to die out. That it's just inevitable. Well, science, you know, science is on the rise, and religion and Christianity is on the decline. It's going to die. Back in 1966, on a very famous magazine called Time magazine in America, There was a famous heading that said, God is dead. Now, at the time, 97% of Americans actually believed in God. Here we are, how many years later? 50-odd years later, I can't do the math that quick anymore. Now only about 63% of Americans believe in God. So that's a drop of 30%, 97% to 63. That's a big drop in the space of two generations. Closer to home, in Australia, it's similar. About one-third of all Australians identify as no religion in the census. And likewise, over the last 20 years, the number of people identifying as Christian in Australia has dropped from 70%, about 70, to about 50. And so, you know, the churches and the belief in Christianity has been going down. Now, some people go even further. They just don't just observe that religion or Christianity is on the decline. Some even go further and say they want to kill it. They want to kill it. So there's one American physicist, his name's Steven Weinberg. He's on the record saying this. He says, anything that we scientists can do to weaken the hold of religion should be done. Now, I'm sure in this room, maybe there's many mixed opinions about whether science has defeated religion. But I'm sure that we could all agree that that there is a perception in our culture held by both religious people and non-religious people that science is in conflict with Christianity. Now, it may surprise some of you to learn that not so long ago, you know, 50, 100, 200 years ago, until recent decades, that theology, which is the study of God, theology was known as the queen of sciences, right? Studying the Bible and about God was the queen of the sciences. So how did we get from Christianity and the study of the Bible being the queen of the sciences to a new perception, a new mentality that science and Christianity are in complete conflict? What started that separation between the queen of sciences and all the rest of the sciences? Well, let me just explain. I hope I'm not being too simplistic, but let me explain briefly a few historical events that were key in the process of this divorce between Christianity and the sciences. The first one goes back to the 1600s. Back in those days, everyone believed that the Earth was the center of the universe. Now, a man named Galileo, he was an astronomer, a mathematician, a physicist, he argued that wasn't correct. Now, the established church of the day, they listened not to Galileo, but their own scientists, who insisted that, no, the Earth is the center of the universe. And they even got the Bible and said, look, the Bible even teaches that that the Earth is the center of the universe. And so the church leaders treated Galileo very badly, very poorly. They forced him to publicly deny his new theory that the sun was at the center. But critics have not allowed the church to forget their dismal blunder from 400 or 500 years ago. The second key historical event that drove a wedge between science and Christianity, or science and the Bible, were several foundational texts or theses that were published back in the mid-1800s. So this is about 150-odd years ago. The first one was written by a scientist called Charles Lyell. He wrote The Principles of Geology. And then there was another guy who you're probably more likely to have heard of. His name was Charles Darwin. And he wrote The Origin of Species and another one called The Descent of Man. Now, Lyell, the first guy, he was the first one to propose that the age of the Earth was much greater than previously assumed back in those days. He said, no, the earth is billions of years old, not just, you know, thousands or millions. Then Darwin took Lyell's idea and he applied it to human beings, to humanity itself. And so with that came his theory of evolution by natural selection. Now, even though neither Lyell nor Darwin, they weren't atheists, these events, among others, again, helped widen that gap between science and faith in God. Now, here's an interesting quote I found. In the later years of Charles Darwin's life, he said this. He said, "When I was a young man with uninformed ideas, I threw out to the people many guesses, suggestions, wondering all the time over everything. And to my astonishment, these ideas took like wildfire. People made a religion of them." And so back in those mid-1800s, when Darwin first started, you know, teaching his theories or writing his theses, he wasn't sure himself, but he's saying other people took him on like a new religion. Now, so we talked about Galileo, then we talked about Lyell and Darwin. There was a third key event, right, with another person, another philosopher, and his name was Friedrich Nietzsche. And he was a philosopher. He rose to prominence during the time of Darwin. So this is, again, mid-late 1800s. And it was Nietzsche, this philosopher, who popularized the phrase, "God is dead." And he encouraged a new way of living, a new way of viewing the world, a new way of living that excluded morals and religion. And so what happened with him is that science and philosophy combined to remove the need for belief in God. And that's had a ripple effect down the years, the decades. And so given these key historical events and movements, and the movements that followed, it's common today for people to feel that there's a conflict between science and religion. And now something that in our present context as well is the media, they love to tell stories, that's their job to tell stories, but when the media tell stories, they love a conflict. They love things in tension, and so they have protagonists and antagonists, and they'll like to show some sort of conflict. And so what happens is that often when things about Christianity, religion and Christianity in particular, are reported, that gives wide publicity to the battles between secular people and religious people. For example, in one camp you might have the young earth creationists. That's the people who believe that the world was made in seven literal days. And, you know, they might be teaching that in schools. And so they'll then report a story about, you know, they've got one group here and the secular group here. And so these battles give credibility to the claims of Dawkins and Harris and others that either you can be a scientific person and rational, or you can be a religious person, but not both. It's one or the other. And so I used to hear my friends at medical school say, "Well, you know, I believe in science. I believe in evolution." And what they were, their assumption or the logic of what they were saying, the implication of what they were saying was that I believe in science and evolution, and therefore I believe these views contradict Genesis chapter 1 about teaching about creation,
And therefore, because I reject creation and Genesis chapter 1, therefore I reject the Bible, therefore I reject God, I reject Jesus, and I reject Christianity. So it's like dominoes. But if I've understood them correctly, the bottom line for them basically was science has disproved God. Science has disproved Christianity. Right. Well, I've put some ideas on the table for you to consider. And now in a moment, we're going to just break up into small groups. You can break up into a group of apps of two or three or four or however many you'd like. And for about 5 minutes, I've got a question for you to discuss. And the question will come up on the screen. The question I want you to just think about now is, what are the scientific objections to Christianity that you have? Or perhaps that you've heard others have? Okay, so it might be similar to what I was saying, or it might be different, but I'll give you about 5 minutes now. So just join in as you feel comfortable. You're allowed to speak up, or you're free to stay silent and say nothing. And then in about 5 minutes, I'll gather back and I'm going to start talking about the next thing. All right, so go for it. And Ella's going to play some gentle background music. Thanks, Ella. One. Okay, well, welcome back. I hope that kicked off some conversation. You can continue. We'll have another, after this next short talk, there'll be another opportunity. There'll also be an opportunity for questions at the end of the three talks as well. So you can, fire your questions at me. And also afterwards, we have some supper where we can all continue conversations as well. But I want us to take the next logical step now as we think about, has science disproved Christianity? And a big issue is evolution and creation. Let me start again with another Richard Dawkins quote. So Dawkins once said, although atheism might have been logically tenable before Darwin, now Darwin has made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Now, as I said before, Lyell and Darwin were actually theists. They believed in God. I'm not saying that they were Christian. I'm not saying that Darwin was a Christian. But they did believe in God, as far as we can tell. However, the domino effect of their ideas and their writings has been that down the decades, down the centuries, countless millions now around the world believe that science and Christianity are at odds, irrefutable odds. Now, at the time of Darwin, what was also interesting to know is that only a few pastors, church ministers, actually challenged his idea about biological evolution. In fact, a lot of the young earth, 6-day creationist teaching, well, back then in the mid-1800s, was rare. And it's mainly emerged a lot later. Now, this teaching that the Bible is only that the earth is only 6,000 years old, it's often based on a literal reading of Genesis, where they get the genealogies and they count up all the people listed in the genealogies, the family trees, and they can work out, well, if he lived for this many years and he lived for that many years, the earth's about 6,000 years old. But we need to ask ourselves this question. Does science in general, and evolutionary science in particular, disprove the Bible? Or can we resolve this supposed conflict? Well, what I want us to do now is go back and think about that first chapter of the Bible, those early chapters. And what I want to do is give you some tools so that you can actually work out the answer for yourself. And I have one simple point to make in this short talk, in the next sort of 6 or so minutes. And my one point is this.
that science and Christianity, science and theology, complement one another, not compete. They complement. They click together. They don't compete against each other. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, what I'm saying is that science and theology are actually answering different questions. Science teaches us how the world was made. Theology, the Bible, teaches us who made the world and why it was made. So one answers how, the other one who and why. You see, science is about process, but Genesis is about purpose. Process, purpose. Oxford professor John Lennox, he's a professor of science and religion. He's the kind of guy that speaks seven languages and just is an expert in every area. But he says this about, he was asked this question. He was asked the question, what sort of things is science good at? And where does science strike its limits? And he replied this with this. He said, quote, science is very good at asking the how questions and the why questions, if you like, where it's the why of function, but it doesn't really deal with the question of intention or purpose. So let me illustrate for you. Imagine for a moment there was a little boy and he walks into his kitchen and he notices that the kettle is boiling. And so he wonders, well, why is the kettle boiling? And so he turns to his dad over here, and his dad's a scientist. And he says, Dad, why is the kettle boiling? And so his dad tells him, well, son, it's because of the combustion of the gas. It transfers the heat to the water, and the molecules of water become more and more agitated. They give off steam, and then there you have it, boiling water. Now, this little 10-year-old boy is not very satisfied with his dad's answer, and so he turns to his mum. And he says, well, Mum, why is the kettle boiling? And she says, well, son, because I want to make a cup of coffee. Can you see the difference between the answers? The father explained how the kettle was boiling. The mum explained why it was boiling. And likewise, science answers how the universe came into being. It informs us about the process, but the Bible answers why the world came into being. It informs us about the purpose. Now, I think a big part of the problem between this perceived conflict between science and Christianity is a failure to understand the style of writing, the genre in the Bible. You see, when interpreting the Bible, what we want to do is we want to understand what the original author was trying to teach us. But often what we do is we take the Bible was written, 2,000 years ago or even 3,000 years ago, other parts. And what we do is we take our 21st century questions and lens, and we often import that back into the Bible. But that's not what the original author was trying to teach in the first place. And so understanding the style of writing or genre is critical. You see, if the original author was trying to write in poetry, we got to read it as poetry, not as science. If the original author was trying to read it as history, well, we need to interpret it as history, and so forth. We don't interpret poetry as history or history as poetry. And so while some Christians, perhaps even some Christians in this room, might disagree with me, I want to argue that Genesis chapters 1 and 2 were never meant to be scientific documents. You see, the discipline of science didn't exist 3,500 years ago when Genesis was written. Moses wasn't trying to write a scientific document. But those early chapters of Genesis are written more like poetry, not a scientific report. It's got, if you read that first chapter of the Bible, you'll notice repetition. You'll notice rhythm like poetry. You'll notice imagery like poetry. Now, I'm not saying that the meaning of Genesis isn't true. I believe it is true. You see, poetry can still speak about real things, but it just doesn't do it in a literal and concrete way. It does it with images and pictures. So we're asking ourselves this question: does science in general, and evolutionary science in particular, disprove the Bible? Well, the answer is no, because science and theology have completely different spheres of authority. They're answering different questions. And so they complement, not compete. Aldous Huxley was a renowned atheist, and he wrote a book called Brave New World, and he makes this same point. He's not even a Christian, and he's an atheist, and he makes this point. He says, science has explained nothing. The more we know, the more fantastic the world becomes, and the profounder the surrounding darkness. And he goes on, listen to this line, and the bout or the fight between science and God is called off due to the fact that the competitors were competing for different titles. He's saying it's like trying to compare engineering and art and saying, well, they contradict each other. No, they're trying to achieve very different things. One's trying to achieve a solid building, the other one tries to create beautiful things. They're not in competition. Now, let me make this final point. Knowing how we got here on this earth is interesting. But knowing why we're here is not only fascinating, but it's also crucial for our fulfillment and happiness as individuals. You see, wanting to know the meaning and purpose of our lives on this planet, you know, sometimes it's looked down on as corny and old-fashioned, but experience shows us that the human heart is never satisfied with merely the what and the how. You see, no one can live with meaninglessness or that feeling of being empty. Our hearts tell us that there must be something more to life. And so science has improved our lives in many ways, but we weren't just made to function like machines. We human beings were made for a higher purpose. As one great thinker once said, there's a God-shaped hole in the heart of every human person, and only God can fill it. And so the real debate about Genesis is actually a literary debate, not a historical or a scientific one. So the literary question needs to be asked first before the scientific or the historical one, because if it's answered first and Genesis is in fact a poetic style of writing, well then the science and the historical debates become absolutely irrelevant. The original author of Genesis was trying to answer the question of who made the world and why he made it. And his answer in those early chapters is that God made the world, God made you and me, because he wants to have a loving relationship with us. And that gets to the very core of the Bible's message. God made you and me. God made the world because he wants to have a loving relationship with us. Right, well, that's my turn. So now it's your turn again to have your say. So we're going to break up for another 5 minutes into small groups and this time discuss a different question. And the question will come up on the screen. It is, are Christianity and science inherently contradictory
or complementary. So you can have your views. So share a little or a lot. Well, let me begin my third talk. So again, in about 6 or 7 or 8 minutes, there'll be some opportunities for questions directed at me. And we're going to hear from one of our PhD students who's doing a PhD in science. We're going to hear his story as well. But we've talked about how the conflict or the perceived conflict between Christianity and science arose. We've also just touched on why it's perceived that, say, evolution and creation are incompatible. Now we're going to look at the question, hasn't science disproved Christianity from a different angle again? We're going to be thinking about faith and reason. And let me begin with I'll go for my hat trick and start with for the third time, another quote from Richard Dawkins. He's got some good ones. He once wrote, "The universe we observe has precisely the correct properties that you would expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." He also argues that you can't be an intelligent scientific thinker and still hold religious beliefs. It's one or the other, Dawkins says, and he supports his view with one study that found of American scientists, only 7% believed in a personal God. And he says this is proof that the more intelligent and rational and scientifically minded you are, well, the less you'll be able to believe in God. Well, that's Dawkins. The other scientists disagree. So, for example, there's John Horton. I don't know. I hope I've pronounced his name correctly. He's the former professor of atmospheric physics at Oxford University. He's also the former chief executive of the United Kingdom Meteorological Office. And he stated this. So he said, well, the size and the complexity, the beauty and the order that we find in the universe are expressions of the greatness, the beauty and the orderliness of the Creator. So he is a physicist, a very, you know, distinguished one. And yet he believes in the beauty of a Creator. Likewise, there's another guy at the same year that Richard Dawkins published his book, what's it called? The God Delusion. Another famous scientist called Francis Collins. He was an atheist. He was the head of the Human Genome Project. And in that same year, this atheist, Francis Collins, actually converted and became a Christian because of his work on the Human Genome Project. And afterwards, he published a book called The Fingerprints of God. The Language of God. And he describes his conversion, how he came to his new position, his new belief as a Christian. So he was a scientist, Francis Collins, with a firm belief in evolution as a biological mechanism, but who rejected philosophical scientism or naturalism. You see, during his work on the Human Genome Project, he came to believe that there was a fine tuning of the universe. He believed the beauty and the order of nature pointed to a divine creator. He said, you look at this world and it's like there's a divine fingerprint. He said, if you just stop and think about this world, it's just so perfect in so many ways. The complexity of the brain. How does it just work so amazingly? He said, if you just look at the way the world is, it's more like it's the work of art of a master, rather than if everything was just random, chance, nothing more than a big bang out of nothing. He says that would be more like putting a bomb in a can of paint and going, poof. Can you imagine doing that? Putting a bomb in a can of paint, making a big bang,
What's the chances that you would end up with an amazing masterpiece? And so when you look at this world, is it more like an incredible masterpiece that works incredibly well? Or is it random and chaotic? Now, Dawkins, on the other hand, he argues that if you believe in evolution as a biological mechanism, then you must also believe in philosophical scientism or naturalism. And so it's not just the method of science, but the philosophy of science. That is, what I mean by the philosophy of science, that's the belief that all you can see, that's the only thing that exists. Matter is the only thing that exists. And that science, therefore, science has the answer to absolutely everything, to everything that can be known. And since the universe consists of only physical matter and nothing else, then essentially everything is just mechanical. And so the supernatural, it has no place. And therefore religious beliefs, they're irrational. And science and religion, therefore, can never agree, is what Dawkins says. Now, for 200 odd years before Dawkins, the 1700s, 1800s, our culture has been growing more and more skeptical about the belief in the supernatural. You see, many people won't believe in God unless there's scientific proof. But stop and think about that for a second. This belief in scientism or philosophical naturalism, that actually requires a leap of faith. That belief system has hidden assumptions. You see, it's a philosophy that we're dealing with. That's not facts. That's not the method of science. It's a belief system based on faith that atheists hold to. You see, there's no experimental model for testing the statement that no supernatural cause for any natural phenomenon is possible. We can't prove that there's no supernatural. And so it's a circular argument. It's saying that science, by its nature, it can't discern or test for supernatural causes, and therefore, those causes can't exist. You get that? So this philosophy is saying, well, of scientism, these people who say they believe in science, they're saying, well, we can't test for the supernatural, therefore, it can't exist. But that's like arguing that, the drunk person arguing who's lost his car keys. So the drunk, he's lost his car keys, and so he insists, well, the keys must have been lost under the street light because the light's better there. In fact, it goes one step further. It insists that because the keys would be hard to find in the dark place, therefore they must be under the light. That's kind of what this belief in science is arguing. Now, what I want to say is that Christians believe in science. We believe in the method of science. We disagree with the philosophy that matter is all there is. But we believe in the method of science. In fact, it was the Christian worldview that helped science to flourish in the Western world. All the early scientists were either Christians or they were influenced, they were shaped by the Christian worldview and understanding of the world. And so those early scientists, the reason they did what they did was that they believed that they were just observing, which is what science does, observing and describing the order of God's creation, which is what, that's the very order that Genesis chapter 1 would teach us to expect.
Now, if the world was just a big bang and it was random and it was all by chance, you wouldn't actually expect order, perfect order and regularity. You'd expect more randomness and chance. And so, if anything, Christianity provides a better basis, a better foundation for an understanding of the method of science. But yet the supernatural is hard to believe. Miracles are hard to believe. And so they should be. Because we don't want to be fooled by trickery. We don't want to be coerced by lies or illusions. So is there a way, I mean, Christians are accused of believing blindly, believing blindly. So is there a way to investigate and test the claims of Christianity in some other way than science, if science can't test them? Well, yes, there is valid grounds to test the claims of Christianity in the Bible. But it doesn't depend on the scientific method. The way we test it is with historico-legal evidence. That is, the claims of Jesus and the Bible can be tested, or they depend on eyewitness accounts. And so they can be tested like every other historical claim. Listen to the claims of the Bible itself. This is the beginning of the story of Jesus, written by a doctor who was called Luke. And listen to his first four sentences. He says this. He said, "Many have taken to draw up an account of things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those from whom were the first eyewitnesses and servants of the word." So there's the word eyewitnesses. "With this in mind, I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning. And I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that have been taught." Can you see what this doctor, Luke, was saying here? The first four sentences in the story of Jesus in the Bible. He's saying that the story of Jesus that he learnt and then passed on came from eyewitnesses. He spoke to them. He personally and carefully investigated everything. He didn't just accept some myth. And then he decided to write an orderly account, a biography of Jesus' life, so that the readers, those who heard, could be sure. And so this is the type, this eyewitness evidence, this historico-legal evidence, this is the kind of evidence that they use in courts of law. This is the kind of evidence that puts people away in jail for years and years and years for murder. It's reliable. It's reasonable evidence in a court of law. So likewise, surely, for the Bible. The trustworthiness of this evidence depends on the trustworthiness of the eyewitnesses, both in a court of law and the Bible. So the question is then, well, are the eyewitnesses who helped us get the story of Jesus in the Bible, are they reliable eyewitnesses? Well, think about this. All the eyewitnesses, Jesus' first followers, his disciples, all of them were willing to die and did die for teaching that Jesus rose physically from the dead. See, before Jesus died, they all ran away from Jesus. But after Jesus died and then came back to life, every single one of them was prepared to die and did die, except for one who died in exile. You see, none of them have recanted. None of them went back on their word. And so they, those early eyewitnesses, they obviously believed it was true that Jesus really did come back from the dead. So is there a way to test the claims, a rational way to test the claims of Christianity? Is it reasonable to believe in God and Jesus in the Bible? Well, yes, by testing the claims of Jesus in a historical, legal manner. Not a test tube, not a stopwatch, not a ruler. They're all the wrong kinds of tools for this problem. And so my encouragement to you, if you're not someone who identifies as a Christian, is to go away and read the Bible. Read it, research, and then make an informed decision. When I was beginning uni, that's what I did. I went away and read, well, how do we know that Jesus came back from the dead? How do we know the Bible was reliable? It was that very evidence that persuaded me, yes, Christianity is true. Jesus must be the Lord, the God of the world. You see, modern people, we're not the only ones that struggle either to believe sometimes. Even those founders, those early eyewitnesses, some of them were looking Jesus in the face and they still struggled to believe that he was a resurrected, a man back from the dead. One verse in the gospel, the story about Jesus, that says when the followers of Jesus saw him resurrected, they worshipped him, but some doubted. There's no other reason that that extra phrase, but some doubted, would be put in the Bible if the Bible's trying to convince people, unless it really happened. You see, Jesus wasn't a magician. His miracles didn't suspend the laws of nature, but he was God in a human body, and what he was doing was restoring the world, showing how as God he can restore the world to the way it's meant to be. He healed the sick. He fed the hungry. He even raised people from the dead. And so Jesus was restoring God's natural, God's good order. He was giving us a foretaste of heaven, what it will be like in the next life, a world without disease and without death. It'll be the world we all want. And that's why the message of the Bible is good news. And that's why, hypothetically, even if you here believe that it's not true, even if you're a skeptic, you should wish the Bible was true. So is it reasonable to believe in God and Jesus? Well, I've given you my opinion. And I hope it's given you some new data so that you, like a scientist, can go away and evaluate this new data and have a fresh look at the evidence. We're going to take a breather now and then have a couple of minutes of questions before our PhD student comes up and shares why he, as a scientist, believes in Christianity. So have 10 seconds, talk to the person next to you. What questions do you have? Do you have any questions that you want to ask? How about we just have 30 seconds? Can you play the music for 30 seconds and then we'll come back together? In your group that, you know, perhaps no one could answer that you'd like to ask in front of the group.
So in the Bible, it talks about demons possessing people. Do we have that much anymore? I'm not really sure if that's specifically part of it, but it seems like something that, I don't know, for instance, science doesn't explain. For instance, how can you explain that?
I guess. Great question. One I've kind of always wondered about myself, like as a doctor, I read some of those stories and I go, is that guy just having an epileptic fit? So I don't know that this will be a perfectly satisfying answer, but let me try my best. And that is to several things. So one, the Bible does affirm that the supernatural is real. And so not only God is real, but also angels and the devil and demons are real. there's real spiritual forces, good and bad, exist, and we can't see them. The other thing, coming back to my talk, is to remember to read literature for the style of literature that it is. So if it's poetry, read it as poetry. If it's historical, read it as historical. If it's law, read it as law. If it's prophetic, read it as prophetic. And so the question is, well, what style of writing is the Gospels? And the Gospels don't just occur in isolation either, but there's a whole two-thirds of the Bible that comes before it. And so when the Gospels are written, sometimes there's things in those stories which are meant to make us go ding, 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 and link our brains back to a part in the Old Testament to say, ah, this is being fulfilled. This promise in the Old Testament is being fulfilled right now. And so what we do see, in our context, we don't know our Old Testaments very well, and so we often just miss the links. But when you step back into, say, Deuteronomy, you see the curses. The prophet Moses sort of promised that if Israel obeyed God, they would be blessed. If they disobeyed, they would be cursed. Now, the story of the Old Testament is one big story of Israel disobeying, and so in the end, they were cursed. And so as we get to the New Testament, they're waiting for the curse to be reversed. Now, the curse involved things like sicknesses and skin diseases and fevers and death and spiritual, you know, evil spirits afflicting people. They were the curses promised in Deuteronomy. So when you get to the Gospels, what do we see? Well, we see Jesus reversing the curse. We see him healing skin diseases. We see him, what were the other things I just said? healing skin diseases, healing fevers. Raising the dead. Yes, he does that two or three times, and we see him as well defeating evil forces. He has power and authority over all the evil forces. And so that's meant to go ding, 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 ding. Here is God's promised king. He's God's promised savior who's coming to reverse the curse and bring in the blessings of God and bring in the new covenant where we will obey God from our heart. And that will be, we'll live with God forever in a good, loving, obedient relationship in God's kingdom. So we need to make those literary and theological links rather than just coming to the text with our 21st century categories and imposing it on the text. We need to get out of the text the message. Yeah. Perhaps one more question? Yeah, Ian. Here's a philosopher. I always get nervous about question times.
So in the New Testament,
yep,
it says that as soon as after Jesus died, when that soldier stabbed Jesus somewhere around here, that writer said that there was water and blood came out from his body.
Mm-hmm.
So when we goes back to the scientifically,
yep, yep,
we like some places they say that in some cases blood get away from the fibers and the yep. rest of the stuff and yep. it become a fluid.
Yes.
Does that mean that whatever it was written in the Bible is false because it's like literally proven that some things happen like this?
Yeah. I didn't say anything was false. I was just saying notice the theological and literary things. But so as a doctor, we've got some doctors sitting over just behind you in the row, and they'll be able to tell you that when people start to go into heart failure and respiratory failure and things, that the fluid can start filling up around the lungs. And so it makes sense if the spear came in that fluid would come out. It would look like water, straw-coloured water, as well as blood. from, you know, a spear going through. So, yep, sometimes they're just concrete. It makes sense medically. And but there might also be a theological purpose for explaining the water and the blood. Don't ask me what that significance is. You can ask Sam Green afterwards if he knows. It's been a question, again, in my brain. I don't know everything about the Bible. It's one thing I've always meant to read about. Is there a theological significance to the water and the blood? But it was also the same with the sky went dark, didn't it? And now that might have been a physical thing, and you can go back, I don't know, ask an astronomer. Was there an eclipse or something at that time? Now, there might have been a real eclipse, but there's also can be literary and theological kind of links back to, say, the prophets. And what the theological significance is that something, not a once-in-a-lifetime thing is happening, but a once-in-a-time thing is happening here with Jesus dying on the cross. Something, the whole cosmic order is being shaken. He's fixing up the problem of the cosmos. And, yeah, so sometimes we need to think literary and theological, not just come with our medical scientific categories to the Bible. Get the original author's purpose out of the Bible before we start putting our questions and our answers into the Bible. Great. For time's sake, I'm happy to take more questions after the service if you've got any. But right now I'm going to invite Darren up. How about we put our hands together for Aaron? Is that Darren, right? Now, Darren, whereabouts are you from?
I'm from Mauritius.
Mauritius. And where's Mauritius? Can anyone guess? Does anyone know where Mauritius is? Yes, one, two, three people, four. We might have a battery problem. Yep, that sounds good. So, Daniel, do you know Darren? This has got your name wrong twice. I don't know why. Tell me, Darren, where is Mauritius?
So, for those of you who don't know, it's a very small country. It's in Madagascar. It's so small on the map that you can't even see it. You have to zoom in.
Yes. So it's right near the bottom of Africa, an island off the bottom of Africa. Tell us now, you've come to Tasmania from Africa. Why are you studying here? What are you studying?
So I'm doing marine science here in Hobart, Tasmania. And I guess most of you know, it's well recognized around the world for marine science.
UTAS,
why I'm here. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Cool. So marine science, and you're doing a PhD. I'm correct in that.
Correct.
Yeah.
So fantastic. I'm doing a PhD, which I started last November.
Yep. So tell me, you're a scientist, right? You're going to be a high, very high level thinking scientist. Why do you believe in God and Jesus and Christianity and the Bible?
So I guess there are two parts to this question. I'll answer first why I believe in God.
Yeah.
And Sam, I think you did a great job already explaining why science and religion can coexist.
Oh, thanks. I'll give you $20 after the service to
thank you.
Yeah,
thank
just
you.
Like we planned, yes. Sorry, yeah, David, you answer.
I think you gave a lot of good arguments, and there are so many reasons why I believe in science and Christianity at the same time. And I just want to reemphasize that one point that Sam spoke about. He said that science, it explains the process, which it cannot go more than this. So it means that it can't explain the purpose behind why humans were created and why things are created,
yes,
basically. So that's one of the reasons.
Yeah.
And then, okay, let me put it this way. I want you guys to understand how science works, because science relies very heavily on replicates to be able to work and explain the process. So I'll just give you an example, which I think most of you guys here know from probably high school physics, which is called Hooke's Law.
So what?
Hooke's Law.
Hooke's Law.
Hook. So it's the theory
Hooke's
of...
Hooke's law. Oh, Hooke's law. Okay, yes.
Yeah, of springs and elastic bands.
Right, yes.
So how they work.
Yes, keep going.
Remember.
Keep going.
I mean, do most people here know what is Hooke's law? F is equal to KE. I don't know.
The smart people are nodding. Keep going, keep going. You explain, you explain.
All right. Okay, so I try to make it simple for you guys. So basically, if you have an elastic band and you want to know, okay, intuitively speaking, if you stretch the elastic band, the longer you stretch it, the higher the force will be.
Yes.
So scientists, what they try to do, they try to put the laws into equations.
Yes.
So in this case, the law is F is directly proportional to KE.
Right.
So K is the spring constant, and E is the spring extension, basically. Sorry, it's getting a bit technical here.
So they repeat again and again and again.
Yeah. So where I want to get with this is different materials, they've got different Ks.
Yes.
The spring constant.
Yep.
So for example, if you take an elastic band, and if you take a spring, a metal spring, the K will be different. So if you stretch the elastic band, let's say by 10 centimeters, the force will be different compared to, let's say, a spring, which you stretch by 10 centimeters.
Yes.
And the reason is because the K is different in this case.
Sure. So you repeat the tests again and again and again, and that proves something.
Yeah.
But what about history? What about history?
Can I just finish the point?
Yeah.
So what I want to say with this is, so how scientists determine the K is by performing experiments. And so they have to do this through a lot of replicates.
Yes.
To be able to know what K is for an elastic band.
Yes.
And for a metal spring, for example. And the reason why science can't explain everything is because, like Sam said during his talk, for things which happen just once in the past, you just can't rely on replicates.
Yes.
So for example, if I was to tell you guys, what did you have for dinner last week? Okay, let's say last Wednesday.
Yeah.
And you want to say, okay, I had some rice and chicken for dinner. And you want to prove it scientifically. And you guys just wouldn't be able to do this, right?
Yep.
And the reason is because it happened just once in the past.
Yes.
And you don't have more than one replicates.
Yes.
And that's why, like you said, Sam, that's why history is so important, because through the study of history, we are able to know things which happened in the past. And through the work of historians, we are able to know how reliable these events were.
Yes. Excellent. Well, if you want to know more about Hooke's law, or if you want to know more about why a scientist might believe Christianity, feel free to talk to Darren after our gathering. Is there any final comments or thoughts that you want to leave us with quickly?
So I will say all the things which Sam mentioned, they are really great. But there's so much more out there which he can cover in 1 hour and which we can cover in just 5 minutes of interview. So for this reason, I would really encourage you guys to do your own research and look into it, because that's so important. First, if you're not a Christian and you don't believe in science and Christianity, that we can coexist, it will help you to understand why we are compatible. And for those of you who are Christians here, it will help you to strengthen your faith. So feel free to ask us any questions or anyone who has looked into this topic afterwards. And it's good, because here at Resonate, we are open to these kind of discussions, and we want to encourage these kind of discussions.
Yeah, fantastic.
Thanks, Sam, for
having me. All right, thanks for your time. Darren, let's put our hands together for Darren. Cheers.